gentlemen. The case is submitted. At 1 o'clock, we will hear the arguments in Cullender against Lawson. Peterson, you may proceed whenever you're ready.
Mr. Chief Justice, may it please the court. Appellants are asking this court to find California's Penal Code Section 647E, as interpreted by People v. Solomon, constitutional. Furthermore, that when the statute is properly applied, it satisfies the Fourth Amendment criteria. And finally, that when the police acting properly under the statute, request a person identify themselves, that does not violate their rights under the Fifth Amendment. Now, the facts are normally, in a case like a Terry Stop case, the facts are normally quite important and very relevant. In this particular case, the facts surrounding the stops of Mr. Lawson are not relevant because the matter will go back down for a trial at the district court level, a jury trial on the facts. Therefore, I think it would be inappropriate, and really they're not relevant to a decision today, not at all. It is first critical to review appellant's claim that the statute is constitutional, as interpreted by the Solomon Court. And our first premise is that because Solomon with Terry, we have clear standards that proscribe the police in enforcing the statute. The court below recognized the statute and grafted the guidelines from Terry through Solomon. Therefore, before 647E ever comes into play, the police must have articulable facts demonstrating their belief was reasonable that the person was acting in a suspicious manner relating to criminal activity. This standard and guideline ensures a tempered act of a policeman. As this court held recently in Cortez, the police action must be considered in light of the total circumstances. The police then act on probabilities after considering the data at their disposal. And it would be impossible to write either a statute or an opinion that encompassed every conceivable situation that could be considered suspicious. And that's a point conceded by appellee. But it isn't even necessary, because we have Terry that sets forth adequate standards against which the police activity is measured. Now, Terry obviously was both loitering and wandering for a criminal purpose, which therefore required the police to respond because the public safety demanded it. Now, Terry provides the standards not only for stops, but also probable cause to arrest. And while those standards may lack machine tool precision,
Terry, there was a frisk. Before there was an arrest,
there was also a request
and
for identification.
And in the frisk, they found a gun.
There was a request for identification, then a frisk,
and then there
then
was
an arrest.
But the arrest was after the frisk.
That's true. But while these standards may lack, as I say, the precision that some may wish, they certainly have provided constitutional guidelines since their inception that have guided courts throughout the country. And California has only memorialized the Terry stop by statute and court opinion intertwined to give us a solid basis upon which to judge these matters. Certainly the standard imposed upon the police to articulate what they perceive as criminal activity is no more onerous than we place on the police in making a stop for a driving while intoxicated stop. As Solomon also provides the second leg of the standard, a standard for what satisfies the request for identification. It must be, to a reasonable policeman, reliable. Now, while this may present some problem to some, we ask all sorts of people to make decisions on reliability.
Does that require someone to carry and produce identification?
No, ma'am. It does not. It does not do that at all. It only requires that the officer be satisfied that the identification is reliable. I'm sure that all of us recognize that there are joggers who go
about. How does one do that without carrying something?
It's quite easy. You query. In other words, a jogger stopped, and we all recognize the fact that there are joggers now applying their trade in sweatpants and sweatshirts because it makes them less noticeable in the jogging atmosphere, and they can run away from their crime. But if a person were jogging and wasn't carrying their identification, the officer would merely inquire where they live and their name, identification. The person provides it. The officer then asks them what the major intersection is near the home, what the route was that he ran to get from there, or where it is in relation to where the person is stopped. All of these things that seem to be unable to be answered by people such as Mr. Powell in Nevada, who couldn't respond to where his friends lived or their name or their address or which direction he was rightfully headed at that time. Those things are ways of getting to the reliability of the identification.
May I ask, following up on it, supposing you stop the jogger, you ask him his name, he says, my name is John Smith, and then you ask him these additional questions about how he ran to that particular location. He says, I would prefer not to tell you. Does he commit a crime?
He has not provided the officer the level of identification that 647E requires under Solomon.
And he has committed a crime.
Solomon says that you must discern where the man can be contacted at a later date if that's necessary.
So he has committed a crime. He says, I would prefer not to tell you. He say he gives his address also. My name.
Oh, if he gives his name and address?
But he has nothing with him. And you say, well, would you tell me what route did you jog over here from? He said, I would prefer
if
not.
If the officer at that point feels that the that in knowing the neighborhood,
so he thinks he's lying.
The address, sure, he thinks he's lying. Then
he's committed a crime.
But certainly. Say
he's not lying. He tells him truthfully what his name and his address is, but he declines to tell him how he got from point A to point B. Has he committed a crime?
Yes, I find it difficult in the scheme of.
Supposing
the
he says
a rational person in an interface with the police not being willing to say, well, I ran down
well,
this
maybe on the way over he robbed someone. Maybe he snatched a purse on the way over. And
sure.
He figures if he tells him how he came, he would incriminate himself. That might be his real motive for not wanting to tell the police officer. But the mere fact he did not answer is a crime.
If he did not give reliable
identification. I told you what he gave.
He did not provide reliable identification because you said that the police officer did not believe.
Does the police officer have to give him any kind of warning? Does the police officer have to give him any kind of warning that the information might help them catch the thief who stole, in my hypothetical case, a purse on three blocks away?
There is no requirement that I know, statutory or otherwise, that requires a policeman to inform a person why he is being stopped. Now, if in the world of common sense and the way that police operate, normally that information does come out. And people are told that.
I understand your explanation of the statute, without any Miranda warning or its equivalent, if a man who is in fact suspected of committing a crime is stopped and asked if he was at the location of the crime and he just says, I'd rather not answer, he's now committed the offense.
No, not if he responded. He would be
the question was, how did you get from A to B? And you said, if he doesn't tell me, he's committed the offense.
That's if he has not provided the officer with reliable identification.
Well, he told him, my name is John Smith.
We're kind of leapfrogging to the Fifth Amendment issue.
Your
I realize that. And if you'd like to discuss that, I think it's
well,
important
to realize. You're telling us how the statute is properly construed at this point as a preliminary to your argument.
There might be other ways of getting to the reliability of the data of the identification.
But it would be an approved way.
Because all we're after with 647E is the man's name and address.
Yeah, but you then said.
Or the woman's or the person's.
You said the customary procedure correctly followed under the statute is to follow up with a question of how did you get from A to B without any warning of the consequences of either answering or not answering.
If the warnings only are given to, can you provide any other reason why I should believe that you live at such an address?
Well, you've told me what you said is the approved way.
That's right. Now the
in a Terry stop, can the officer reach into the pocket of the suspect and pull out his wallet and check for ID?
Under Wisconsin law, they certainly can. Wisconsin Supreme Court in Flynn decided that and said they could. And also,
was that part of a pat-down process in Wisconsin?
No, it was part of asking for an identification. It wasn't, to my understanding of Flynn, it was not part of seeking weapons. It was the officer wanted to find out who the person was, and he reached into his pocket and
took
his wallet.
Has this court ever said that that's all right under a Terry stop?
Not to my knowledge, they haven't. They denied cert in Flynn, but, of course, that doesn't necessarily.
Would the California statute then allow the same information to be obtained, but in a different way?
We feel that there are certainly ways to ask for a reliable identification without interfering with the person's Fifth Amendment rights, as Justice Stevens raised. We feel that there are certainly ways of and avenues of inquiry which can be used that will bring about the information that is non-incriminatory.
The California courts have interpreted the statute to require the person stopped to account for his presence or her presence.
That is.
What does that mean?
That means that you provide reliable.
That's the sort of inquiry you're talking
that's
about.
That's right. You must only provide reliable identification. That's all that's required.
You keep saying identification, and I think you must mean information, don't you? Because the third question Justice Stevens has proposed, or that you propose, is not identification at all. How did you get
here? Well, the what you're getting to is identification. The reliable the information to verify that the identification is reliable is what he was getting to, I believe. If I read his question correctly.
Well, no. He gave you the name and the address, and you.
That's right. He said, "So my name is John Jones, and I live at 25 Main Street." And the officer, for some reason, disbelieved him, and then said, "Well, can you tell me how you your route that you jogged, or can you?" And that would have incriminated him. Perhaps anybody said, well, you know, I live at that address, and the next intersection is Main and Elm, and that's nearby, and the officer would recognize that and recognize the information as reliable. I think that's reasonable, and I think it's reasonable police action that we're looking for.
Suppose
here.
Suppose the officer is basically on the lookout for the neighborhood rapist who is believed to drive a blue car. Then under this statute, can he go on and inquire about how did you get here? Did you travel in a car? And
well, if we're talking about a jogger, no. No, once the person is given reliable identification, he may not. Under Solomon, the person must be allowed to proceed. That doesn't mean that in some time in the future, when the detective who is investigating the neighborhood rapist comes upon various names seen under suspicious circumstances, that he cannot go to the person's home and make further inquiries under other circumstances. That's just normal investigation.
How about right there on the street?
No, that isn't authorized. You must allow him to go on his way once he provides reliable information. If what he tells you triggers additional suspicions, such as what occurred when Mr. Powell was stopped in Las Vegas, then certainly a policeman would be remiss if he did not inquire further.
May I ask one other question?
Sure.
What about the account for his presence language in the statute?
The account for his presence language has been interpreted by Solomon to mean only that you provide reliable identification.
And
not that I'm here because I want to stand and watch something, or I'm not here because I'm here at the corner because I'm supposed to meet someone. That's not part of the procedure at all.
Just all it goes
and
to
the
is
Solomon Court has said that.
Well, if it weren't for that language, I would have been puzzled by your statement that the correct practice under the statute would be to ask a question such as, what are some of the neighboring streets, or how did you get from there to here? You think that goes to reliability of the identification?
That's right. If they were, as you stated, the officer disbelieved the person.
See, you have, I suppose, by hypothesis, at the time of the stop, the officer suspects him of being engaged in criminal activity.
Already has articulable facts to justify the first intrusion.
Right, so he thinks he's involved in criminal activity.
Right.
And he says, I want to ask you your name and so forth.
That's right.
But he doesn't tell him he thinks he's involved in criminal activity.
No, most of the time people will, the interchange will result in that. However, there's no requirement, as I stated before, that I know where you have to notify someone why you are stopping them. It just happens that most people are. You have to notify them at the arrest time.
And you don't have to notify them if you say, how did you get here? Even though the purpose of the question is to find out if maybe he's the person.
No, the purpose of the question is to gain the reliability of the information. If you suspect him as a purse snatcher, you're focusing in, and your Fifth Amendment comes into play, of course, at that time. But just asking a name and address, as cited in my reply brief, designated as, for lack of a better word, pedigree information. That doesn't require a Miranda warning before you acquire that.
This statute provides, would you say, wider latitude to police than the Terry stop?
No. No wider latitude whatsoever, because they're inextricably intertwined. They form the basis. All we've done is memorialize Terry with a statute and say that Terry applies and you can stop a person and ask them for identification under Terry circumstances. It's a Terry stop.
But if under Terry you can't compel someone to produce their wallet and their ID, how is this statute not broader than Terry?
Because Terry did not get to the issue of requiring the person to provide his identification. I think the only place that was mentioned was in Justice White's concurring opinion when he said that when they asked him for identification and he told them, Mr. Terry told the officer what his identification was, in Justice White's opinion he said that if he had chosen not to tell him, he could have walked away. And under these facts and circumstances, we feel that there's a reasonable governmental interest in having the person provide his name, and the people of California have so stated
through their
legislature.
So it may be broader than Terry if Justice White's view is correct.
If Justice White's view is taken as part of the opinion, it might be a tad broader. But still in all, I think by the same token, it's more restrictive, too, because if you don't have reliable information under which you think your safety is at stake, you can't pat them down. You can only ask for their name. And it allows a lower level of intrusion than a Terry pat-down. And that's what makes this very reasonable. It's eminently reasonable that if a person can is suspected of criminal activity, but say it's a prostitute on the corner, or say a bookmaker in a barber shop or something like that, where you wouldn't normally feel that your life was in danger, so it wouldn't justify a pat-down search, you could still, with articulable facts justifying a detention, the initial detention, you could still inquire as to their name and address and their identity.
What do you say are the articulable facts that supported the stop here?
There were 15 of them.
Well, just take the last one.
Basically, and as I said before, I'm really didn't come prepared to discuss the facts of the case because they're going to be litigated again, because the Ninth Circuit sent it back for a jury trial on whether or not the person was stopped. But let's take the first time, which is one that I am familiar with, when the person was walking along a darkened road in the nighttime hours, and there had been a series of car clouts in the area, and the person was not wearing a raincoat, although it was a rainy night. The person was so it would appear that he wasn't from the immediate neighborhood, that he was from outside the area, that he was not walking along the edge of the street, that he was walking out toward the middle, according to the officer.
Well, how much you haven't got to the appearance yet. What about the appearance attracted the officer's notice? Or is that...
As far as my recollection is that the facts were what the officer related as connecting the person to the to criminal activity, middle of the road walking on a dark street without any lights, might be hit, car clouts in the area, might be car clouting. And
that
the fact
mean
that he
vandalism,
that's it. Yes. So those were the facts. As I said before, I think that to get into the specific facts and argue the specific facts of these things isn't proper, since it will go to trial again on those facts.
But of course, it won't go to trial on the question of the respondent's guilt or innocence or not. It just goes to trial, doesn't it, on the issue of whether or not there was good faith on the part of the officers?
That's true. But it will go to trial on that, and the good faith on the officer's part certainly depends to a large extent upon the facts surrounding each of the stops.
Did the district court make any finding as to the need for the injunction issued in this case, whether there was a likelihood that the stop would recur?
He did not, and in my reading of his ruling, did not. We are in the process of seeking to have the injunction lifted until this decision from this court comes down, but we have not proceeded on that until following our appearance here. I would like to hit on the or to just mention the reasonableness of this type of a stop before we conclude, because I think that the governmental interest to deter and detect crime is a major societal interest, a weighty social objective, I think it was stated in Brown. And the intrusion of being asked for identification, this court has characterized in Brignone Ponce and Martinez Fuerte and Mendenhall as being limited intrusions or modest. Whereas when you ask somebody to assume the position and be frisked, that is a serious or severe intrusion that can result in great indignity. And I think that's a fair statement. And so when you put that on the scales and you weigh the great governmental interest against the minimal intrusion of asking for identification, I feel that that it's fully justified under the circumstances. I don't I feel that anybody at the bench, the bar, or in the audience who was faced with a situation where they saw someone walking around their house on public streets, where people have a perfect right to, at odd hours in the early morning hours, and because you were concerned, or I was concerned, we called the police, that we would think it was not reasonable that they asked that person what their name was. I think it's perfectly reasonable. Now,
if you ask everybody's name in New York, you sure lead a whole lot of...
I still think it's a valid safeguarding tool. Well, and I think it's important that they be allowed to do that. And I think that the concern of the freedom to move has got to be weighed against the freedom of other people to move also. And each one interfaces with the other one. An absolute right to wander, you wouldn't even be able to arrest somebody. You'd have to lead to total anarchy if you lead it to its logical conclusion.
Your latest hypothetical about a person seemingly lurking around a house late at night prompts this question. What if it's high noon in Times Square?
I certainly think that the time and the place and the total circumstances, just as in Cortez, the total circumstances play a large role in it. In Cortez, it was the time of the night, the position of the car.
Is your answer that at high noon in the downtown district in Los Angeles, with no indication of usually associated with drug transfers, just simply a person walking along, that this statute would not authorize a stop?
No. Not unless there was, it was in the daytime in an Ohio city where Mr. Terry was stopped, and I think that would...
No.
That was Cleveland, in the middle of the business district, right in front of the Statler Hotel.
That's right. And so, I think it was daytime, and at that, because of the, without any other facts, it's what prompts the stop.
Are you suggesting some peculiar rule that applies to Cleveland but not to the rest of the country?
Oh, no, not at all. Not at all. I'm sorry if I left that impression. My impression was to state that a man in high noon who is exhibiting any criminal tendencies certainly wouldn't be stopped, because or is walking up and down looking like he's looking for a cab. That's completely different. It's what the totality of the circumstance. I'd like to reserve some time for rebuttal.
Mr. Rosenbaum.
Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the Court, this case raises fundamental constitutional questions regarding the broad exercise and extension of police authority and the relationship between that authority and an individual in a free society. Through 647E, police make and enforce as elements of a criminal law requiring innocent persons to disclose proof of identification upon official demand, deliberately imprecise and evolving standards designed to govern investigatory activities. Analysis of 647E therefore turns upon two basic concerns, which, with the Court's permission, I will address this afternoon. First, whether the incorporation of the so-called Terry standard as an element of the 647E offense based upon the moment-to-moment decision-making by a police officer deprives that statute of any objective core, and if so, whether it thereby impermissibly offends due process vagueness doctrine by encouraging arbitrary and discriminatory enforcement, by denying fair notice, and by trenching upon basic constitutional rights of privacy, security, and mobility. And second, whether 647E works in two ways to undermine the central importance of the probable cause requirement. Whether it offends the Fourth Amendment by sanctioning intrusion upon individual security and privacy upon less than probable cause and upon no other interest than the general one in crime prevention and detection, but not as Mr. Peterson would have it, based upon whatever incremental advantage exists through the existence of a criminal sanction, and whether it also subverts Fourth Amendment guarantees by converting the power to make inquiry and to investigate upon less than probable cause into the power to arrest and search, absent functionally at least, the existence of probable cause. Let me start with the vagueness issue, and let me pay particular attention to the issue which Justice O'Connor has raised, the question of whether or not this statute, in fact, requires persons within the state of California to carry and to display at all times upon official demand proof of identification. For in practice, 647E is functionally indistinguishable from the very sort of stop and identify statute in application which this court specifically disapproved of in Brown versus Texas. The consequence of 647E is that in California, there is an internal passport requirement. This is true because the basis for a Terry stop and demand, an officer's basis which Mr. Peterson described, is both unknown and unknowable to anyone but the detaining officer, including, of course, the individual detained. And this is true for two reasons that go to the heart of the Terry decision. First, the decision to stop an individual under Terry is one that is peculiarly dependent upon the skill and the experience and the training of the officer. As Justice Powell stated in Mendenhall, and as the Chief Justice has stated in Cortez and in Brown versus Texas, this sort of skill and experience and training simply is not available to the average layperson.
Would you say then that a case in which a Terry stop was made is not reviewable by the courts because it's so esoteric they just wouldn't know anything about it?
No, of course not. What Terry established was an objective standard for courts to review whether or not a stop which took place in the past was constitutional or not. But the critical point for our purposes with respect to notice is whether the individual on the street, the person who is being detained by the officer, can make a judgment at that time as to whether he or she wishes to state his or her rights under Brown versus Texas and say, I don't believe you have reasonable suspicion here. I don't want to have to disclose my identity to you. I want to rest upon my rights, or whether the person has any opportunity to make that sort of judgment.
What if the statute spoke in terms of probable cause and not articulable suspicion? Would that affect your argument on this point at all?
Well, that's an interesting question. I would say first that if the statute had a probable cause requirement, it would first of all probably be an unnecessary statute because, as Justice O'Connor indicated earlier, at that point the officer can conduct a search. The officer can actually reach into the individual's pocket. But with respect to the vagueness question that you're asking about, Justice Rehnquist, I would say it would be a close question. But I would say that there is a difference, which this Court has recognized on numerous occasions, between probable cause and reasonable suspicion. Probable cause comes with a lot more freight.
Sure.
And in addition, probable cause is a recognition in this society that we will accept different sorts of relationships between the individual and the law enforcement apparatus.
But that's true of articulable suspicion, too, isn't it, if you phrase it in those terms? Articulable suspicion is some sort of halfway house between probable cause and nothing. It's better than nothing, but not as good as probable cause.
It may, yes, and because of that, we will permit the police to make certain intrusions upon individual privacies that we won't permit in the nothing situation. But the issue, as far as notice is concerned, is whether the individual on the street is capable of making the judgment as to whether the officer who's doing the detention.
Do you think that individual has any better basis for making the judgment if it's probable cause? Do you think the typical layperson really knows what the components of probable cause are any more than they know what the components of articulable suspicion are?
Well, let me answer that in two ways. First, as I indicated to Your Honor, it is a close question. But probable cause comes with a different set of freight, and it is more understandable. Moreover, we are talking about a vagueness doctrine. And as this Court has repeatedly recognized, last term in the Hoffman Estates case, the drug paraphernalia case, the Mesquite case, the case involving the licensing ordinance, we will adjust our vagueness standards depending upon the constitutional rights that are involved. In the probable cause situation which you hypothesize, we are willing to draw perhaps a less strong line in terms of what we will expect from the individual itself. But the basic point, of course, is that in the probable cause hypothesis that you state, there simply is no need for the sort of statute that you're describing in the first place. And returning again to the notice point that we're talking about, the problem of the individual on the street not having the skill and the training and the experience of the officer is compounded because, quite fundamentally, that individual simply doesn't have the information available to the officer. What precipitates the Terry stop may be an informant's tip, as in Adams versus Williams, may be a DEA profile, as in Reed versus Georgia. It may simply be a call from the patrol car. But whatever the basis of that information, the individual on the street who ought to be able to reside comfortably with the knowledge that at the very minimum, that individual has the rights guaranteed by this Court in Brown versus Texas, simply has no way of making an assessment as to whether or not a forfeiture ought to exist here, whether or not it is proper to disclose identification.
Is this you think this is your strongest point here, counsel?
I have two strong points with respect to vagueness, Your Honor. The first is the notice.
I mean, do you think the vagueness argument is your strongest point?
I think both the vagueness argument and the Fourth Amendment arguments are compelling in this particular case. The other prong of the vagueness argument that I want to focus upon that complements this particular notice requirement is the fact that as an incorporation of the Terry standard within 647E, that incorporation means that the statute has no objective core. It is like the Massachusetts flag desecration statute, which this Court ruled unconstitutional in Smith versus Goodwin. Like the phrase there, treats contemptuously, there is no basis here for an objective standard because what is taking place here is that an element of the crime is being defined by the moment-to-moment decision-making of the officer on the street. What 647E does is to codify an officer's suspicions regarding wrongdoing and then to criminalize the failure of an individual to allay those particular suspicions or to furnish information. And while we are perfectly willing, as a matter of recognizing the importance of investigations, to say that where that standard appears as part of an investigatory statute or part of an investigatory standard, to consciously relax our standards of vagueness.
Is your argument that the statute is vague or that it's overbroad?
It is that the statute is vague because it is not capable of any constitutional application. There is no way that this statute can be applied without causing a forfeiture of the rights which this Court guaranteed in Brown versus Texas. And it is because
you say it's not capable of being applied in any situation.
That's correct. Because whether you look at vagueness or whether you look at the Fourth Amendment argument, what is inherent in this statute is a forfeiture of the rights of privacy and security and mobility that were guaranteed under Brown versus Texas. The arbitrary and discriminatory enforcement, therefore, flows from the use of this investigatory standard as one of the elements. And as I indicated, while this Court has stated that it will relax standards of vagueness in circumstances short of a criminal sanction, where the element becomes part of it, different constitutional considerations flowing from the fact that a breach of a criminal statute results in arrest and imprisonment mean that we have to use a tighter consideration. And if there be any doubt that this statute in fact works arbitrary and discriminatory enforcement, this Court need only look at the facts of this case and the studies perceiving urban realities that we've cited in our papers. For in this case, Mr. Lawson, a black man of unconventional appearance, was stopped not less than 15 times over a 22-month period on occasional visits to the San Diego area, always in white neighborhoods, always by white officers. And on not one of those occasions was he ever charged, arrested, or prosecuted for any other offense.
Would you think if, added to whatever the other facts were, the respondent here, the appellee, was wearing a stocking cap over his head with holes for the eyes?
That would also be an unconventional appearance.
Well, I was thinking of something a little more than unconventional.
That of course, would permit a Terry stop, but it still wouldn't answer our basic question with respect.
Well, would it fit under this statute? Could he be properly stopped under this statute if he's at night, after dark, stocking mask over his face?
Yes, the individual
could be stopped.
Yes, could be stopped and could be requested for identification. But the question in this case is not whether or not those questions can be asked. As Justice White indicated in Terry, those questions may be asked of any individual detained.
Yes, but they could detain him until they ask the question.
That's correct.
You agree with that?
That's correct.
But your point is he should not be forced to answer the question at the pain of criminal penalty.
That's correct. And turning to the Fourth Amendment analysis, it was your statement in Terry itself, in the concurring opinion, as has since been restated, both in Davis, where it was regarded as, quote, settled principle, and in Dunaway versus New York, that really indicates the underpinnings of the Fourth Amendment argument here. Because this statute undermines the Fourth Amendment in two particular ways. First, as Justice O'Connor was indicating, what it does is to, in every application, dissolve the probable cause requirement unless an individual is prepared to waive his or her constitutional rights with respect to interference with police officers. This statute, if you think about it, is really nothing more than a newfangled variation of the same sort of vagrancy law that this Court struck down in Papachristou versus Jacksonville, because there it manufactured probable cause to arrest persons appearing suspicious. This statute manufactures probable cause to arrest persons appearing suspicious who refuse to allay those suspicions. Let's look at how this statute actually works.
May I interrupt with one question?
Certainly.
Following up on the Chief Justice's hypothetical question, supposing an officer does encounter in the 3 o'clock in the morning in a residential neighborhood a person wearing a stocking cap with eyes in it, is there anything he can do to that person? He can stop him and ask him questions and say the man says, I won't answer. Is there any remedy that's available to the police?
The officer can ask the questions. If there is no response, as Justice White pointed out in Terry, that can alert the officer's need for continuing observation. But it is the Fourth Amendment that answers the question that you pose, Justice Stevens. Because if the failure to answer and to do nothing more than place the individual under close surveillance.
But can the officer attach evidentiary significance to the failure to answer if you assume there's a constitutional right not to answer?
If the officer could do that, then what would happen is there would be probable cause to arrest and this statute would not exist.
You mean it'd be all right to stop him, and if he doesn't answer, say, well, now we've got probable cause? And
No. To the contrary, that's the nub in this particular statute. If a refusal to answer, and it's just a simple question, what's your name, and the person just stands silent, If, in fact, that would not cause enough information to be added to the initial suspicion to cause probable cause, then the Fourth Amendment demands that the person be let go. More questions could be asked. The officer could say, why won't you give us any answer? What are you doing in this neighborhood? Whatever questions a trained officer believes appropriate. But if at the conclusion of those questions the officer doesn't have enough information to form probable cause, then the Fourth Amendment mandates that the individual be released and whatever appropriate surveillance continue, whatever appropriate observation continue. But that's a balance that I'm not making. That is a balance that is inherent in the probable cause requirement.
But you're saying that there's no way a state can pass a statute to deal with the hypothetical case I give you that would enable the officer to elicit the name and address of the person from an unwilling if he didn't want to give it.
That's correct. And that really comes close to what the case, of course, is all about. That is the relationship between law enforcement and the individual and what may be our repugnance on civic bases or moral bases to individuals not furnishing answers. But to go so far as to arrest because of failure to provide information without anything more, this isn't a Michigan versus DeFilippo case where the person first says, I'm Sergeant Mash, and then I'm someone else. And that may accrete enough information to cause probable cause. Short of that, the officer cannot arrest the individual for failure to give name and identification.
Would you suggest that if there is probable cause to arrest and everybody concedes it, the state could then say that once there's probable cause to arrest, it is also a crime to refuse to give the name?
No, because when...
No what?
No, I think that would be improper. I think first it would most likely be unnecessary because of...
So you're making an... It wouldn't be a Fourth Amendment argument.
No, there's a Fifth Amendment problem that would...
So that's where you would...
Right. Once the probable cause to arrest takes place, then we have either a custodial interrogation setting or something remarkably close, and it would be Fifth Amendment considerations that would govern our judgment. But I want to return to how this statute works with respect to probable cause in its actual operation. What is the day-to-day application? Not a fanciful hypothetical, but how does it really work? An officer approaches an individual and detains that individual. The individual is frozen. The officer says to the individual, what is your name and address? And the individual doesn't answer. Perhaps is silent, perhaps refuses to answer whatsoever. What is the state of affairs in terms of Fourth Amendment constitutional doctrine at that time? Well, we certainly, assuming the officer has in good faith made a Terry stop, we have reasonable suspicion. But we don't have probable cause to make that arrest. And what that also means, under Terry and this Court's decisions in Robinson versus United States, in Gustafson versus Florida, is that the officer at that point cannot make a search. Then what happens with 647E? The statute is activated, an arrest is made, and the officer at that point can make an arrest and a search and obtain the very information which moments ago the Fourth Amendment precluded. It is a probable cause manufacturing machine. Let's look at it another way. An officer goes up to a person and wants to reach into the person's pocket to get the ID, but is precluded by the Fourth Amendment because they only have Terry. The officer says to the individual, you reach in your pocket and get identification, and the individual refuses or is silent. 647E is activated, and it is the law. It is the law that then permits the officer to reach into the individual's pocket and extract the very identification which just moments ago the probable cause requirement absolutely forbade. There is no way.
It would also authorize a complete search incident to arrest.
That's correct. It is more. It is more than just a reaching in for identification. It is that plus. Because then the individual is subjected to all the constitutional deprivations that attach to the arrest and to the full search that Justice White just mentioned.
Where do you get that from? Where they can make a full search?
They can make a full search incident to arrest.
Custodial.
Yes.
On the street?
Yeah.
That's what this.
I thought you could make a pat down.
Perhaps I'm not being clear. I'm discussing the situation where, under this statute, the officer obtained probable cause.
You're getting too far away from this case.
Well, what I'm saying is that actually your point indicates how the Fourth Amendment can be subverted, because they start with Terry and very limited powers of the frisk, and all of a sudden, with 647E entering the case, it is the full search incident to arrest that is permitted. And that's one of the Fourth Amendment problems with the statute.
Terry gives you that same sort of acceleration in its on the facts of Terry, doesn't it? If you reach in and find someone who's carrying a concealed weapon, and carrying a concealed weapon is a crime, all of a sudden you do have probable cause.
Yes, and that's because the society has recognized that the possession of a concealed weapon is a substantive offense that we will punish and permit to have a search incident to afterwards. But what's the substantive offense in our case? In our case, it is a crime out of what is not a crime. All the person has done is refuse to allay suspicions, either silently, or noisily, or whatever, and all of a sudden that becomes, not like a concealed weapon, but that becomes the basis for the full arrest and search incident to arrest.
Well, that's what the court approved in Michigan against DeFilippo, though.
Yes, but in Michigan versus DeFilippo, the court declared that statute there unconstitutional, and that issue.
But surely, if the statute had been constitutional, it all would have followed.
If the statute is constitutional, my argument obviously falls. But what I'm indicating.
No, but your demonstration of what flows from the statute, I mean, is exactly what happened in DeFilippo.
Yes, and that. But the question is what happens to the probable cause requirement in those circumstances. And that's just one of the ways that the probable cause requirement is undermined in this particular case. Let's look at what this does with respect to permitting intrusions upon constitutional rights of security and privacy and mobility upon less than probable cause for the governmental interest here that is accrued through the existence of a statute that penalizing the disclosure of identification. And in this respect, I would direct the Court's attention to its decisions in Terry and Brignone-Ponce and Summers. In Terry, this Court stated that it would permit a frisk of an individual beyond a stop upon less than probable cause, but not upon a general interest in crime prevention or detection. Rather, the Terry frisk was specifically predicated upon preserving an officer's safety in circumstances that would warrant a concern. It was not prevention or detection, though obviously that option was available to it.
But the initial detention is, of course.
Yes, and what we're looking at in this case is what will we permit short of probable cause in addition to a stop. And it is our position that this Court has never permitted an intrusion of this sort of character beyond the stop itself for an interest just in the generalized one in crime prevention or detection. That's what Terry indicated with respect to the justification of the frisk. Let's look at Brignone-Ponce, which I would contend in many ways controls this case. Indeed, I would suggest that Mr. Peterson's argument simply cannot be squared with the holding of that case. In Brignone-Ponce, this Court examined a roving patrol that was interested in determining whether or not aliens in violation of immigration laws were being transported. And this Court stated that upon less than probable cause, upon reasonable suspicion, such a stop would be permitted. Now, what is significant about this case for our purposes here is that particular stop, that particular intrusion to ask questions regarding immigration status, was purely an investigatory act. It was no less investigatory than the sort of stops of Mr. Lawson that took place in the San Diego area. But what is critical here is that investigatory stop was sanctioned not upon the general interest on crime prevention or detection, which Mr. Peterson would like to sustain this statute on, but rather was predicated very specifically on this nation's peculiar problems in the area of immigration. And the court will recall Justice Powell at pages 881 and 82 specifically stating that any further intrusion beyond asking about immigration status or asking about the suspicious circumstances regarding immigration would not be permitted under the Fourth Amendment, that there had to, at that point, be consent or probable cause. So in circumstances remarkably identical to the circumstances here, the general interest in crime prevention or detection was not enough to sustain the intrusion. And I would submit to this Court that that is predicated upon an understanding as to really the degree of advantage that law enforcement gains through the actual operation of a statute like this. Not, as Mr. Peterson would have it, some sort of global discussion of crime prevention or detection, but rather what is involved simply by having this particular statute available. Let's look at that. By Mr. Peterson's own tally, there are only some 8 states in the Union, only some 8 states that even have statutes like this. And neither Mr. Peterson nor any of the amici filing papers on his behalf has cited to this Court a single study or a single fact that would indicate that it is the existence of this statute that is responsible for the advantages gained. Nor would the statute itself preclude investigations from going forward. For, as Justice White has indicated in his statements, the individual is still under police surveillance. The officers are still free to continue whatever surveillance. And perhaps the most interesting point at all flows from the record in this case, because when you examine the 15-odd stops that happen, in the majority of stops, when the officers sought to obtain information from Mr. Lawson regarding identification, they didn't use the statute as the basis. That statute's advantage as an increment to crime prevention or detection, while I am not suggesting is insubstantial, while I'm not suggesting is non-existent, certainly is not of the sort of magnitude that would in any way cause the gross departure from the probable cause requirement that is stated here, that is suggested here by the government's argument. And it is really here, in appreciation of that fact, and in appreciation of the discussion that we had with respect to vagueness, that it becomes clear as to what this case is all about. For it is here that the fundamental policies of vagueness and the Fourth Amendment coalesce. For while in circumstances short of probable cause, it may be our moral and civic judgment that individuals questioned by the police should respond, including even disclosure of identity, what finally defines the character of a free society and separates it from a totalitarian one is ultimately the relationship between the individual and the law enforcement apparatus. How much space exists, whether one is free or whether one is subservient. And in the end, this case is much more than a case about the amenities of life. What this case is about in a free society is nothing less than the integrity and the autonomy of the individual, and what our collective repugnance will be to an attempt to destroy those particular values. If the Court has no further questions, I have completed my argument.
Mr. Chief Justice, may it please the Court. Appellate seems to merge his lack of notice and Fourth Amendment rights together in arguing that a person really doesn't know what might constitute suspicious behavior and trigger a 647E detention. Now, this is true of any arrest. Now, if I or anyone else happens to be dressed like a criminal, physical appearance of a criminal? Well, the police report comes in that a crime has been committed. and the criminal was dressed in a certain way, had a certain
physical
appearance.
If he meets a description that's
meets
been
a description
sent out.
And is driving a car that was used in a crime, could be perfectly innocent. Happened to me once. You stopped. There's nothing wrong. There's absolutely nothing wrong there. And I was not put on notice that dressing that way, appearing that way, or driving in that car was anything other than completely innocent. It was. However, I was stopped. And it can happen to anyone. And that's, you cannot put the onus.
Mr. Peterson, that seems to demonstrate the validity of your opponent's argument.
No.
The person stopped
not so.
Doesn't know the basis for the stop.
That's right. And that,
so
that
how
wasn't
does he
necessary.
Know,
I identified
so,
myself
I know, you
and
did,
was allowed to go
but
on.
But how does the person stopped know whether the statute requires him to answer the question?
It's not necessary. There's no way you can possibly let everybody know what in any particular set of circumstances is going to be suspicious to a policeman. It's
so your answer
impossible.
Is that the person stopped can never know whether he has an obligation under the law to answer the question.
Once the policeman asks him, he has the law obligation to answer.
Even if the policeman doesn't have reasonable suspicion?
Probable cause, reasonable suspicion.
But does he have an obligation to answer if the policeman does not have reasonable suspicion?
He's got a good lawsuit afterwards.
But you didn't answer my question.
For the civil suit. Yes, he has an obligation to answer because you have an obligation
well,
under
then
any arrest
the statute
under
is not confined.
Yes,
then
sir.
The statute is not confined in its application to cases in which the officer has reasonable suspicion.
Neither are cases of arrest always confined
well,
with probable
but,
cause
but that's
to
the
arrest.
Way you, speaking for the state of or city of San Diego, interpret this statute.
For state of California, yes.
State
sir.
Of California.
Because otherwise all your obstruction
well,
of justice.
Well, maybe that's the way what you need, but I just want to be sure that's your position.
Well, that's contrary to the California Court of Appeals decision in Solomon, isn't it? That you can be required to answer under this statute if there isn't reasonable or articulable suspicion under Terry?
The thing is, you're getting down to the practicalities. In a legal sense, no. But you're relying on your police to be imposing this code section constitutionally.
Well, so,
and anybody can do anything improperly.
Well, of course,
is all I'm
but,
saying. But certainly, you expect them to have the articulable facts.
We don't need counsel to inform us of that. I don't think. But supposing in the Superior Court of San Diego County, a prosecution was brought under this ordinance, and all the prosecution proved was that the defendant had been stopped and asked for information, and it was clear there was not Terry grounds for stopping the individual. Wouldn't the defendant be entitled to a directed verdict at the close of this prosecution?
Certainly,
case?
And he probably would bring a lawsuit for false arrest, civil suit. I'd also like to mention the fact that what he's after is a right to anonymity, not a right to freedom of movement, and nothing. There's no constitutional right to anonymity, and I think it is very eminently more reasonable to require identification of a person than it is to, in every instance,
well, if you,
you can't
really
stop
mean,
unless you got a right to pat down.
If you really mean what you say, well, you can make it a crime to refuse to identify yourself, whether there's reasonable suspicion or not. There's no constitutional right to anonymity. And therefore, if a policeman walks up to you without any reasonable suspicion and just happens to ask you, what's your name, and you say, sorry, it's none of your business, you could commit a crime.
No, not
well,
without the articulable fact.
There is a constitutional right, then, to anonymity.
Well, yes, under most circumstances, I'd have to agree with you, yes. But not when you're found under suspicious circumstances of Terry. Most statutes, by the way, of this type are city and county ordinances and are not state statutes. And empirical data would be impossible to develop because you would have to have identical law enforcement agencies, identical societies, identical laws, and that's impossible. There is a duty not to arrest, and not to resist arrest, even if the arrest is improper. And there are obstruction of justice statutes throughout this country that would all be held unconstitutional if we didn't have the standards. But I submit that under the standards of Solomon and 647E, thank you.
Thank you, gentlemen. The case is submitted. We'll hear arguments next in...